Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we're live from Brooklyn today. And it happens to be the birthday of a food writer named Patience Gray. She was a very lesser known, but very influential food writer and lived from 1917 to 2005. You know, she's been called the greatest food writer that you've never heard of, but I'm really excited to talk more about her today with the author of a biography about her. So I'm joined today by Adam Fetterman on the line from Vermont. Is that right?
Yeah, Vermont. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Adam. And congratulations on this book. I'm curious, though. You've been an investigative reporter. You earned a Russian Fulbright Fellow. You've been a Middlebury Fellow. You have written for The Nation, The Guardian, Columbia Journalism Review, Gastronomica, and many other journals. But is this your first full-length book?
This is my first book, and it might seem somewhat unrelated to my other work, but I've always had an interest in food, and have actually worked as a cook. Bread baker and pastry chef, and was always, you know, interested in food writing and food writers. So when I came across Patience after she died in 2005, I read an obituary in the Art of Eating magazine that described Honey from a Weed as one of the best books that will ever be written about food, and that certainly piqued my interest. And that was kind of the beginning of what turned into a very long 10-year project.
Yeah, it sounds like, and you mentioned that the editor of The Art of Eating, you found that it was surprising to hear such glowing endorsements from a more critical, usually, editor.
Yeah.
And it seems like Patience was something of like a secret amongst this very, influential inner circle of chefs and food writers. So you mentioned that Patience was beloved by the likes of Alice Waters, April Bloomfield, and more. But to most of us, she was pretty unknown.
Right. I mean, she didn't have much of a presence beyond that sort of small circle of food writers, as you mentioned. And many of them actually went to visit Patience. They were so kind of taken by her work, which was really singular, that it actually inspired them to make the long trek to Puglia to visit her, including Ed Baer, the editor of The Art of Eating magazine, Corby Kummer, Harold McGee, Alice Waters, Nancy Harmon Jenkins. A lot of people sought her out because I think in part because there was this somewhat mysterious aura about her.
Yeah, that is pretty fascinating. So her seminal work is called, Honey. My notes are all over the place.
Honey from a Weed.
What is so singular about this work?
Well, it really brings together sort of narrative nonfiction writing about the many different places that Patience and her partner Norman lived throughout the Mediterranean and writing on food, including recipes, of course. But to describe it as a cookbook is really not to give a complete picture of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she had a very difficult time finding someone to publish the book, in large part because it is so unusual, mm-hmm. unconventional, you know, for a cookbook. But
yeah, it's... Sorry, go on. It sounds like very influential editors wanted to publish it, but it was too risque for a long time.
Yeah, there were some. I found an amazing letter, actually, from Judith Jones to Patience's publisher, Alan Davidson. So Alan Davidson, the founder and publisher of Prospect Books, ultimately did publish Honey from a Weed. It came out in 1986, so a little over 30 years ago now, and... he was trying to find someone in the United States to take it on because he felt that it would have a real kind of impact.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote to Judith Jones and, you know, asked her if she'd be interested in doing this. And she wrote back to say that she had actually seen the manuscript at some point and fell in love with it and kept, you know, portions of it when she needed that kind of, you know, sustenance. But she also went on to say that Knopf would never take on something like that. At that time, you know, the publishing world had changed, and you're right, you know, they weren't willing to take that kind of a risk on a book that, you know, in the end, it actually sold very poorly in the United States. despite its critical reception, it sold very poorly. So it's one
it's
of the nice things
phenomenon.
About
yeah.
having kind of rediscovered her today is that Honey from a Weed is again being, you know, introduced to a new generation of readers.
Mm-hmm. Now... Isn't that sort of maddening, though? So many people passed up on this, what, you know, so many have called now so influential. What was so crazy and not mainstream friendly about it? I know she talked about wild foraging. She lived in a very remote area of Puglia.
Right.
And she was talking, she basically grew most of her food. Did people just didn't think it was relatable?
I think it was partly the structure. Structure of the book. It's just not a standard kind of recipe book. And also, yeah, I think part of it was the fact that she was writing about a place that was so far afield. However, I think today that might not be such an issue.
That sounds great.
Right,
inspirational.
It sounds like the kind of thing people would would jump at.
Right.
But, you know, we have to remember 1986 was a little bit before the sort of interest in really exotic and remote I guess, places and the kinds of food and traditions that sustain them. So who knows? Maybe the book would have had an entirely different reception today.
Right. And I think it's really great that you've picked up and sort of further embellished her story today. Greatly so. This is a very, very intoxicating biography, I have to say. It's I haven't read too much of Patience Gray's work, but I need to now because you're this work is so wonderful. But, you know, you write that at the end of the introduction, you write, indeed, her hope that a more traditional approach to food and cooking would take root, even among city dwellers, has exceeded the most optimistic expectations. Honey from a Weed lives on, a source of inspiration to many, but Patience herself remains an almost forgotten culinary star. So, yes, this approach... This back to the land, basically traditional approach to food, and it is definitely. I mean, you see it in all the finest restaurants, in all the great cookbooks. You know, are extolling the seasons. For instance, they're organized by seasons these days, and that was very much what Patience was writing about.
Absolutely, and I think this idea of nose to tail eating, you know, really. Making the most of what you have and not wasting anything. I think that idea is something that in the last 10 years has, mm-hmm. has you know, reshaped the way we think about food and, in fact, the way we eat and you know, largely for the better.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's interesting that she was very much removed from, let's say, the Northern California 60s, 70s back to the land movement in America. Where a lot of us associate the slow, you know, the growth of this food movement coming from. She was in a completely disparate, like distant land. And yet those values that she treasured. She was a little ahead of her time, but she was not even, you know, part of this movement.
Right. She really wasn't, and she decried being attached to any kind of group or movement. Was very much an individualist. But, you know, some of the same forces that were encouraging people to or pushing people to embrace some of the ideas that were part of the Back to the Land movement here in the United States were mm-hmm. also, you know, bubbling up in Europe. And Patience and her partner Norman, they met in 1958 and left London in 1962. So it was really at that very charged political moment that they chose to leave
mm-hmm.
the big city and begin their travels. So, I think it's interesting to look at those trends mm-hmm. across continents.
Why do you think, Adam, more people should be... Why do you think we should revisit Patience Gray today? What can we gain from that?
I think one of the most important things really is this central idea to her cookbook and to what she felt was the foundation of Mediterranean cooking, which was built around fasting and feasting. And it, you know, it was partly seasonal. In the case of Naxos, the Greek island of Naxos, where they lived for a year, it was also part of the religious, you know, rituals around Lent. But, you know, scarcity was something that patients felt made eating and food that much more pleasurable and meaningful when it was present. So mm-hmm. I think that's an idea that we probably have lost touch with almost entirely, even though we may think of ourselves as somewhat more enlightened when it comes to eating seasonally and foraging and all the rest. We always have an abundance of whatever it is we seem to want. And I think that was something that patients looked, somewhat skeptically at.
Mm-hmm. And it's also great to sort of be able to flesh out an individual who was a writer, but was very much a shadowy figure even during her lifetime. It seems like there was a hunger to learn more about her, and there was just not very much left. There's not very much information besides her, you know, seminal book.
That's right. And that was one of the other interesting things after reading Honey from a Weed. It is a very autobiographical book, and you get this remarkable sense of who Patience was. But at the same time, it reveals almost nothing about her past or who she was. And that tension really is what grabbed me, because I wanted to find out, well, who was this woman? How did she end up writing this remarkable book?
How did she end up in this island or, you know, this area that it was so far removed from where she grew up?
Yeah, and of course, you know, she had a long career before they left for mm-hmm. The Mediterranean. She was, you know, she was 40, 42 or something like that when they actually left London. And she had a remarkable career both as a cookbook author and artist,
mm-hmm.
Journalist. You know, she was the first editor of the
Plat du Jour.
The Woman's Page, right, Plat du Jour in 1957, and then she went on to edit the Women's Page at The Observer. From 1958 to 62. She was one of the translators of Larousse Gastronomique, the French Encyclopedia of Cooking. So she had her hand in a number of interesting...
Yeah. And these are like classic books of, you know, classic housewife, you know, cookbooks of the post-war era that she played a hand in here.
Plat du Jour was published in 1957, so Elizabeth David had already kind of paved the way to mm-hmm. some extent with her
Mediterranean, summer cooking. Yeah, and it sounds like Patience, rather than sort of building on that fame, she eschewed it. She turned away from it. She refused to do an updated revision of Plat du Jour, for instance.
Right. I mean, that was one of the really intriguing things as well that I found in the
strange.
Archives,
mm-hmm.
the Penguin Archives, is that there was this opportunity to come out with a new edition of Plat du Jour, and it likely would have allowed Patience to continue publishing cookbooks, you know, throughout the 60s and 70s. But Patience's ideas about food and cooking were changing rapidly at that point, and she had a falling out with her co-author, who she had written Plat du Jour with. The amazing thing is, you know, 30 years later, she reemerges with Honey from a Weed.
Mm.
And, you know, at that point, I think very few people had really remembered Plat du Jour, but Alan Davidson, who was always, you know, very
her publisher,
her publisher and quite had his ear to the ground. He did another edition of Blatt du Jour, and the book, that book has also lived on.
It's incredible.
Beloved.
So two very different sides of Patience Gray are still out there very much in the world. I want to get to know more about why she kept shape-shifting and reinventing herself. But we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
All right, we're back chatting more with Adam Fetterman. He was helping us uncover the mysteries of Patience Gray, the life, a visionary food writer. His biography is called Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray. You mentioned Elizabeth David, and I think we may have mentioned MFK Fisher. Where do you think Patience falls in this line? Is she a very different type of writer when it comes to food writing?
I think her writing shares some similarities, certainly with David and MFK Fisher. I think stylistically more with MFK Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
And Plat du Jour was much more in the tradition of what Elizabeth David was doing, but they went in completely different directions. You know, Elizabeth David devoted herself to much more scholarly work, and Patience was off, you know, kind of foraging and collecting edible
being
plants.
Sort of a throw-like figure, yeah.
And it's interesting, Patience, you know, she talked about that in some of her letters, the fact that Elizabeth David was writing from, not from life or experience, but from books, and Patience kind of came to see that as somewhat flawed.
Mm.
But, you know, they were contemporaries, they were of the same generation, they had all lived through the Second World War, and I think they really reshaped the genre of food writing and made it turned it into something that was taken seriously as a form of literature.
Mm-hmm.
She's certainly part of that tradition.
Right. So you came across Patience Gray in 2005 when she was already no longer with us. How hard was it to track down her past?
It took many turns. You know, I had
it took the last 10 years.
I had the great fortune of working with her children, who were remarkably open and willing to give me access to her letters and unpublished papers. So her son, Nicholas, has lived in Puglia in the farmhouse that Patience and Norman lived in up until Patience died in 2005. Norman died in 2000, and Nick has been there ever since. I got in touch with Nick and his sister, Miranda, and Nick said, come down. You're welcome to look at the... He called it he said it was in a state of horrendous chaos, and that I would take one look at it and, you know, beat a hasty retreat to find a saintly monk to write about.
That's
the archive was much too tempting.
Oh, that's great. So it sounds like Patience really was critical of the society that she grew up in and her family, too. And she completely, you know, doesn't regard this period of time at all in... I can never say honey from a weed.
Yeah.
This whole period of time, she grew up in a very privileged household. Did she find that this just too suppressive?
I think there were many aspects of her childhood that she found oppressive and railed against and spent much of her life trying to break free of. At the same time, she did have a lot of remarkable opportunities for a young woman, and opportunities that her two sisters were not granted. You know, she went off to boarding school in London at the age of 12 or 13, traveled in Eastern Europe, Romania, went to the London School of Economics. She was incredibly curious and precocious, but she always felt that her parents and their Edwardian, you know, background and upbringing had been stifling, and, you know, was something that patients wore, you know, as a bit of an albatross around mm-hmm. her own life, as something that she kind of had to constantly beat back.
Right. And yet, it was her family's wealth and fortune that allowed her to explore this independence and travel and so forth. So it's
indeed
interesting.
And I think her mother, Olive, gets short shrift in Patience's, her own memoir. And, you know, Patience's children were very fond of their grandmother. So there were a lot of, there's a lot of mythology in any autobiography, and I think Patience certainly had her own version of you know, what her family was and how she felt about it.
Mm, interesting. And she, it seems that she herself regarded herself as her own life really beginning in her 50s or so, when she and her partner moved to Puglia.
Yes.
So this whole other period was just not as important.
In many ways, she kind of wrote it out of her own life, especially the period before the Second World War and her relationship with the father of her children, a man named Thomas Gray, whose name she took but never married, had three children with him. One of them died, and this was, you know, right in the middle of the war. She leaves him in 1943. And goes to live in a cottage that belonged to her mother, Olive, in the countryside. And that period during the war, I think, was both formative and quite challenging.
Sounds like it's incredible to be able to live so many lives. And she lived quite long, too. So it's a remarkable story.
Despite the fact that she was a heavy smoker, which a number of food writers who went to visit her were somewhat surprised to discover.
Wow, must be that something about that Mediterranean air or something cleanses it. It's a really fascinating journey that you take us on with her life and all the changing sort of seasons of a life and attitudes towards food. So why did she write Honey from a Weed? Was she trying to sort of cement, like, this is no longer me, that Plat du Jour, the other, you know, cookbook eras. Was she trying to leave a lasting legacy?
That's an interesting question. I don't think it was so much a self-conscious decision to demonstrate that she had...
Because she didn't seem like she craved, you know, fame and you know, stardom.
No, certainly not. And I think I don't think anyone would write a book like Honey from a Weed craving any kind of fame or limelight, because, you know, she toiled away at this thing and was relatively unwilling to compromise, even though she knew that it was extremely difficult to find. You know, she worked hard to find a publisher for almost 15 years. She had agents in London. She was somewhat, you know, she was relatively well connected because of her career as a journalist in Hampstead.
Right.
So, you know, she knew what she was doing, and she was willing to
wait.
You know, to write a book like this, and knowing that it may not end up seeing the light of day.
She had the patience, so to speak.
She did. The perseverance. And for her, I think it was more about the work and the artistry involved in, you know, whether it was jewelry making, sculpture, or, you know, writing about food.
Do you think that all this time, kind of just working on it, waiting, not caring if it didn't, you know, land, but hoping that one day it would, do you think that during this time she was able to sort of work on it more and let it simmer and the ideas mature?
Undoubtedly. And you see that in the various versions of the book that she wrote. She revised it significantly, at least twice. And then, of course, when Alan Davidson agreed to publish the book, they had a remarkable correspondence. You know, the book was edited via letter. You know, they sent letters back and forth at a furious clip. And those letters are just absolutely astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
So the book, it changed. It changed over time, and then Patience's way of thinking changed. And also, of course,
it evolved, you know, with her.
Yeah, and their life in Puglia, she incorporated much of the traditions and foods from that part of Italy.
Incredible. I love hearing about stuff like that. It's like, you know, nothing needs to be rushed. You know, just let it, like a good stew, good stock, just let it simmer, you know? It'll acquire a deeper flavor. But I'm struck, though, because it was only published in the mid-80s. By this time, you know, there was Chez Panisse, there was already a quite established Back to the Land movement, as I was saying, and growing worldwide. So this came out, this didn't inspire that, but yet it still struck a strong chord with that movement.
Absolutely. No, it certainly wasn't the only book out there either that was talking about some of these ideas. But I think that the way Patience wrote about what she described as a fast disappearing way of life and why it was so you know, meaningful to both to her and she felt you know, more broadly, I think that is what captured people and you know, challenged. I think it challenged them too. It's not necessarily an easy book, and
yeah,
I think for whatever reason, the food world was really swept away by it.
Yeah, definitely. So, do you think that folks should read that first and then dig into the biography? Because many haven't.
read them together. That's perhaps okay. The best way. I one of the great things is actually to see Honey from a Weed, as I mentioned earlier, being rediscovered.
Uh-huh.
I think that Prospect Books is still publishing it, and I know that they're struggling to keep up with orders. So.
Oh, really?
It's a good sign.
That's fantastic. I wonder if there's going to be a movie.
Who knows?
Hey, yeah, I'm curious if you heard any murmurs about that since your book has come out.
Oh, there are always rumors, but nothing more than that. So.
Really? Okay. Well, keep us posted.
I shall.
But seriously, since your book has come out, have you seen a growth of interest? I'm sure you know you've been at the heart and center of this, you know, resurgence because you've written this book. But what has it been like? What are the reactions that you hear from all kinds of folks? I know that there's wonderful accolades and quotes on the back of your book from, you know, Harold McGee, Deborah Madison, Corby Cummer. What about folks who hadn't heard of her before?
Yeah, I think I probably heard a little bit less from them since the book came out. It hasn't been that long, but I think the fact that there's obviously great interest in Honey from a Weed, so I have no doubt that people who had never heard of Patience are discovering her, and really that's the way it was for me. You know, I had no idea who she was, and embarked on this project. And I think one of the great things about her work is that it does have this great staying power.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that it really does depict a world that is very different from the one that we live in today.
I should mention that it's not just food writers and chefs who love this book. It's also novelists, like you mentioned, the late Jim Harrison and others, who really found her writing to be incredible.
Yes, Angela Carter, a British novelist, as you mentioned, Jim Harrison described Patience as a wandering Bruce Chatwin of food. And clearly that's just a testament to her prose and the kind of element
style
of her work that's very difficult to pin down.
Mm-hmm. I think that, yeah, it sounds like, I mean, I've touched on some of her work, but I just can't wait to pick up a copy now of Honey from a Weed. Just this hard, esoteric book now that I'm sure a lot of people are looking up with much thanks to not an obituary, but now your book. So thanks so much for bringing attention to that anew, to a new generation.
Thank you. I'm very happy that it came to be. There were certainly moments when it appeared that it was not going to happen. So.
You struggled to find a publisher?
I did. It took me quite some time to try to find a publisher in England, and that didn't end up leading anywhere. So it was really just a stroke of luck that Chelsea Green
approached
me.
Yeah. I was like, I mean, I love Chelsea Green. We've had a lot of their books on this radio station. Mm. So I thought it was really cool that it was coming from Chelsea Green. I had no idea that it was so hard, and even a British publisher didn't happen. So, well, congratulations
to
that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Adam, and thanks everyone at Heritage. That's about all the time we have for today, but we'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Never had no loving like this
before. Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.